creating arguments in favor of anthropomorphic global warming or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, that's
the rantings of a too much Humboldt County gold, I think.
I would read on the counter. I would read Jeffrey St. Clair's article. I would read Coburn in relation to nuclear power because he understands the corporate history of that. And I would also read Jeffrey St. Clair's articles on Counterpunch having to do with the copying out or the co-opting of the aspects of the environmental movement in relation to nuclear power.
Right. Well, he calls the Indian Point near New York the most dangerous plant in the country. I think it's more likely it's Dresden on the Illinois River. There's not as much population around it, but that's the oldest, and it's a Mark I GE. And
I'm going to be a hometown boy in this case and vote for either San Onofre or Diablo Canyon out in California.
All right. And you're off next week, day after April Fool's Day?
Yes, I'll be missing next week. I'll see you in 2 weeks.
Bon voyage.
Thanks.
It's time for the Labor Hour. Thanks for listening. Opinions of those other speakers. Thanks for your support. WEFD, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio.
Call us working class. The wind is not working. Hello, folks, and welcome to the March 26, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming online at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour of programming are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management or board of directors, Prairie Air Incorporated, or the associates. Now here's Jason with acknowledgement of some of our underwriters.
And before getting to that, happy birthday, Sherry. I love you. This hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. Also, the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Bob?
All right. I'm your host, Bob Polesny, here today, along with co-host Jason Kozlowski. And David should be back next week. David Johnson should be back next week. Tom Thomas should be back next week. And we're still hoping maybe Bill Gorrell shows up yet today to add his commentary to the program. We'll kick it off with Jason with some workers' interest news.
This is breaking from this morning and courtesy of Eric Kleefeld at Talking Points Memo. Yet another shoe has dropped in the battle over Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's anti-public employee union law, with state Republican leaders now apparently defying or attempting to circumvent a court order that temporarily blocked implementation of the law. Last week, a judge in Dane County, around Madison, blocked the law on procedural grounds, ruling that a key conference committee used to advance the bill and to get around the state Senate Democrats' walkout from the state had violated the state open meetings law by failing to give proper 24 hours notice beforehand. The judge's order, quote, restrained and enjoined the further implementation, end quote, of the law, including the prevention of Secretary of State Doug LaFollette from publishing the act in the Wisconsin State Journal, which acts as the state's official newspaper for the purpose of giving the public official notice of new laws, which is the final step for the law to take effect. That decision is now going through an appeals process, which remains up in the air. But now, state Republicans have had the bill pushed through a different office, the Legislative Reference Bureau, the LRB, which handles drafting and research for the legislature, according to the LRB's statutory requirement to publish legislation within 10 days of enactment. Interestingly, the LRB itself says that this publication does not constitute action that would put the law into effect. However, the state's Republican leaders disagree. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, Republican, says the LRB publication constitutes official publication and insists the law will take effect today. Bob?
Okay, Jason, thanks. Here's a story out of Maine. Up there, Governor Paul LePage has ordered the removal of a 36-foot mural depicting Maine's labor history. He wants it removed from the lobby of the Department of Labor. Workers' advocates describe the move as a mean-spirited provocation amid the administration's high-tension standoff with the unions. Acting Labor Chief Laura Boyette emailed the staff on Tuesday about the mural's pending removal, as well as another administration directive to rename several department conference rooms that carry the names of pro-labor icons such as Cesar Chavez. According to LePage spokesman Dan DeMeritt, the administration felt the mural and the conference room's monikers showed one-sided decor, not in keeping with the department's pro-business goals. This is the Department of Labor that they're talking about here. Pro-business goals. He says the message from state agencies needs to be balanced, said DeMeritt, adding that the mural had sparked complaints from some business owners who complained it was hostile to business. Judy Taylor, the artist, said Tuesday that her piece was never meant to be political, simply a depiction of Maine's labor history. The 11-panel piece depicts several moments, including the 1937 shoe mill strike in Auburn and Lewiston, and Rosie the Riveter at Bath Ironworks, and the paper mill workers' strike of 1986 in Jay. Taylor said, "There was never any intention to be pro-labor or anti-labor. It was a pure depiction of the facts." And another one of the conference rooms there that was getting renamed was named after Francis Perkins, the U.S. Labor Secretary under President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Perkins became involved in labor reforms following the 1911 Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that resulted in the deaths of 146 garment workers in New York City. But I guess the Department of Labor is supposed to be pro-business these days.
That's right, and as we talked off-air, as Rob Corddry succinctly said on The Daily Show several years ago, we all know that facts have a liberal bias. You know, just to pause briefly on this before getting to the rest of the news stories, this is just so important because it goes to show just how extensive these right-wing attacks are on working people nowadays, because this goes well beyond purposes of legislation and taking away people's rights. I mean, this is nothing short of an attack on working-class culture,
right,
and people's historical memories. I mean, you're looking at the elimination of depictions of workers, children, by the way, on these murals who worked back then. I mean, why would you want people to remember that children were employed and maimed and at times killed in industrial accidents and treated like human dish rags?
Working when they were 10, 11, 12 years old and stuff like that, you know?
Yeah.
We want to remember that, you know?
Yeah, apparently that's biased in order to acknowledge these basic elements of our own history.
Right, right.
It's deplorable.
Yes.
Well, moving on. And this is courtesy of Misha Gauss at Labor Notes. As radiation from Japan's nuclear disaster appears in its drinking water and food, it's sobering to be reminded that it doesn't take a natural disaster to unleash radioactivity into the environment. All it takes is an indifferent corporation. Honeywell International pleaded guilty in federal court March 11th to knowingly storing hazardous waste without a permit at its Southern Illinois facility, Metropolis, which is a felony. Toxic uranium byproducts were held in 55-gallon metal drums. Workers said the radioactive corrosive slurry started eating through the walls of the drums within months. The company paid an $11.8 million fine and will be on probation for 5 years. No managers were charged. The violations occurred at Honeywell's uranium conversion plant in Metropolis, Illinois, where the corporation locked out 228 members of United Steelworkers last June. Union members say they blew the whistle repeatedly, alerting regulators to the hazards years before any action was taken. The Metropolis facility processes raw uranium into components for nuclear fuel. Since the lockout, it has been operated by SCAB, some of whom were coached by managers when they took the tests that qualified them to run the plant. The fine stemmed from Honeywell's decision to stack up 7,500 barrels of toxic byproduct from the conversion process around the plant, roughly the size of a football field. The facility is near the Ohio River, which workers feared could become contaminated if toxins leaked. Metal drums of the byproduct began stacking up around the facility. They were not intended for long-term storage of the highly corrosive material. 27 workers from the plant, meanwhile, have been diagnosed with cancer, and about 42 have died from various cancers over the past 20 years. Part of the lore of the plant, workers say, is to expect that the job could take 10 years off of their lives. Honeywell, meanwhile, denies any connection between the production process and workers' ailments. Bob?
Thanks, Jason. Here's a story out of the New York Times, reported by David Kuchniewski. General Electric, the nation's largest corporation, had a very good year in 2010. The company reported worldwide profits of $14.2 billion and said $5.1 billion of the total came from its operations in the United States. Its American tax bill? None. In fact, GE claimed a tax benefit of $3.2 billion. That may be hard to fathom for millions of American business owners and households now preparing their own returns, but low taxes are nothing new for GE. The company has been cutting the percentage of its American profits paid to the Internal Revenue Service for years, resulting in far lower tax rates than at most multinational corporations. Its extraordinary success is based on an aggressive strategy that mixes fierce lobbying for tax breaks and innovative accounting that enables it to concentrate its profits offshore. GE's giant tax department, led by a former Treasury official named John Samuels, is often referred to as the world's best tax law firm. Indeed, the company's slogan, "Imagination at Work," fits this department well. The team includes former officials not just from the Treasury, but also from the IRS and virtually all tax writing committees in Congress. While General Electric is one of the most skilled at reducing its tax burden, many other companies have become better at this as well. Although the top corporate tax rate in the United States is 35%, one of the highest in the world, companies have been increasingly using a maze of shelters, tax credits, and subsidies to pay far less. Such strategies, as well as changes in tax laws that encourage some businesses and professionals to file as individuals, have pushed on the corporate share of the nation's tax receipts from 30% of all federal revenue in the mid-1950s to 6.6% in 2009. That's just ridiculous that corporations are only paying 6.6% in 2009.
Yet the trope from so many on the right is about how high corporate tax rates are, when they're always talking about paper tax rates, not the actual ones, which officials are just extremely low.
Yeah, here's some other statistics about that. During the Great Depression, federal income tax receipts from individuals and corporations were roughly equal. During the Second World War, income tax receipts from corporations were 50% greater than from individuals. The national crisis of depression and war produced successful demands for corporations to contribute significant portions of tax revenues. But U.S. corporations resented this arrangement, and after the war, they changed it. Corporate profits financed politicians' campaigns and lobbies to make sure that income tax receipts from individuals rose faster than those from corporations, and tax cuts were larger for corporations. By the 1980s, individual income taxes regularly yield four times more than taxes on corporate profits. So, and they say the same thing. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, corporations paid taxes on their profits and totaling $24.7 billion in 1988, while individuals then paid income taxes of $90 billion. By 2009, corporate tax payments had roughly doubled to $49.1 billion, and individual income taxes had more than tripled to $290 billion. So it's going the wrong way.
Yeah, happy days are here again.
Yes.
Man, well, this is courtesy of the Washington Post. Michigan moved on Thursday to significantly cut its unemployment program, becoming the first of what could be a flurry of debt-laden states to reduce aid, even as high jobless rates persist. The Michigan measure reduces the maximum period a person can receive state unemployment benefits from 26 to 20 weeks, the lowest in the nation, officials said. Governor Rick Snyder, Republican, indicated Thursday that he would sign the bill. The state's economic troubles, aggravated by the recession and a shrinking manufacturing base, have turned Michigan into a bellwether of bust. Its unemployment rate stands at 10.7%, one of the worst in the country. The move comes as other Republican-dominated legislatures, including Florida's, are weighing similar efforts to restrict payments to the jobless, and states such as Wisconsin, Ohio, and Indiana are implementing far-reaching controversial plans, allegedly, to close budget gaps. Opponents argue that it makes little sense to reduce benefits now when many Americans are finding it difficult to get work. The nation's jobless rate stood at 8.9% in February, and nearly 44% of the country's jobless have been out of work for more than 6 months, according to the Labor Department. Moreover, opponents fear that Michigan's approach on unemployment benefits could be copied by other states, with energized Republican majorities, just as the collective bargaining restrictions approved in Wisconsin have been entertained by other states. This is frightfully short-sighted for the individual families, said United States Representative Sandra Levin, a Democrat in Michigan. It turns back the clock 50 years on these benefits. Since the 1950s, nearly every state has offered at least 26 weeks of unemployment insurance. At the same time, this month, the Florida House approved a measure reducing the maximum benefit period from 26 to as little as 12 weeks, while curbing increases in unemployment taxes paid by employers. The jobless rate in Florida is 11.9%. We are sending a message to the business community that Florida is quickly becoming the most business-friendly state in the country, said State Rep. Douglas Holder, a Republican of Sarasota, the sponsor of the Florida bill.
Bob? All right, I got a story here. The U.S. Postal Service is offering a $20,000 buyout to thousands of veteran workers as part of its bid to eliminate 7,500 administrative jobs, the agency announced on Thursday. The struggling agency also announced plans to shutter seven district offices. Those seven offices that are closing are Columbus, Southeast Michigan, Northern Illinois, Southeast New England, South Georgia, Big Sky, and Albuquerque. There are 421 jobs spread across the seven offices, a Postal Service spokeswoman said. Eligible administrative employees will be offered the buyout package. Letter carriers and other union workers are not eligible. The postmaster first announced plans to cut 7,500 positions in January, but it wasn't clear where those jobs would be cut or when. The buyout offer is designed to entice workers to leave the workforce. Each year, about 20,000 Postal Service workers retire or leave their jobs, but many of those positions are filled. By eliminating 7,500 administrative positions over the next year, the Postal Service should be able to accelerate the shrinkage of its workforce. Employees must be 50 years old with at least 20 years of service or any age with at least 25 years of service to qualify. But that's a struggling agency. It says the organization has also asked Congress to allow it to scale back to five-day delivery, cutting Saturdays, and to discontinue its unique retirement to requirement to pre-fund its retirement fund, something no other federal agency is required to do. So, but you were mentioning scabs in your story about Honeywell down there.
Is this a segue to a number?
Yeah, an Ann Feeney song. So
we're on the same page as far as musical selections today, Bob.
There you go. Ann Feeney with Scabs.
There's an alien life form been creeping round my job site. Oh, they look almost human, but something about them ain't right. They just cross right over a picket line. Pay no attention to a picket sign. They're called scabs, scabs. The lowest life form spawned in nature's lab. They got no brains, they got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. They might be reptilian. The blood flows like ice in their veins. Or extraterrestrial recyclers that use shit for brains. Now what does it mean to have the right to strike when companies do anything they like using scabs, scabs. The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brains, they got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. Now, before we had our unions, let me tell you, conditions were bad. Understaffed, overworked, underpaid, till we finally got mad. But then when we walked out to protect our rights, they just gave away our jobs to those parasites, to those scabs. The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brains, they got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. I could puke watching co-workers turned into weasels and traitors. They must be pod people hatched by those corporate raiders and insider traders. You know our labor laws are crazy. They're so damn two-faced. They say I haven't been fired, just permanently replaced by scabs, scabs. The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brains, they got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. Oh, listen to your mama, this is an idle gab. You're pretty damn low on the food chain when you think you gotta grab your striking neighbor's job. I guess you gotta be a scab.
Ann Feeney and her thoughts about scabs. And we continue here with Women's History Month on WEFT, so we always love to play some Ann Feeney during that time.
Yeah, the great Ann Feeney.
Yeah, yeah. And Bill was saying last week he thinks she's recuperating down in the Caribbean somewhere.
I hope so. She deserves it, and, you know, we hope Ann gets well
yes,
soon.
Yes, yes. So, okay, how about we head into some Hightower radio news?
We love Hightower.
Yeah.
change is not the same thing as progress. In fact, change can be the exact opposite. It can be regressive, as we're now learning from, where else, Congress. A flock of Tea Party-infused Republicans has certainly changed the political dynamic in Washington, and exultant GOP leaders are claiming that they are now the voice of the people. But most people won't find themselves represented by this change, much less see it as progress. That's because the newcomers in Congress, whether Republican or Democrats, tend to live high up the economic ladder, way out of touch with the people they're representing. Indeed, 40% of newly elected House members are millionaires, as are 60% of new senators. While the great majority of workaday Americans are struggling to make it on about $30,000 a year and having at best puny pensions and iffy health coverage, these incoming lawmakers tend to be sitting pretty on accumulated wealth. Their financial reports show them holding extensive personal investments in such outfits as Wall Street banks, oil giants, and drug makers. Their wealth and financial ties might help explain the rush by the new Republican House majority to coddle the corporate powers. From gutting EPA's anti-pollution restrictions on big oil to undoing the restraints on Wall Street greed, they're pushing for a return to the same laissez-faire land ideology of the past 20 years that got our country in massive messes. At the same time, they're out to kill the Green Jobs Program, bust unions, cut Social Security, defund Head Start, and generally stomp on the fingers of working families trying to hold on to the middle-class rungs of that economic ladder. This is Jim Hightower saying, the change in Congress is taking America backwards, not forwards, for the new majority literally is the voice of millionaires, and that's not progress.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
All right. We always like Jim Hightower and what he's got to say there.
Amen.
How about if we go to a cut from Workers Independent News here?
We also love Workers Independent
News. Yeah. Right out of Wisconsin, the heart of the battleground these days. Actually, on Wednesday of this week, they had a special report, a look at budget and right-to-work battles across the country. So this is kind of interesting. Talks about what's going on in a lot of other states and stuff. So
the belly of the beast.
Yeah. Yeah. Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. While much of the nation's attention has been focused on the ongoing protests and recall campaigns going on in the state of Wisconsin, the Badger State is only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to legislation targeting collective bargaining rights. Casting an eye out of the Midwest, you'll find reports of similar but smaller movements afoot. For example, in South Carolina, hundreds of protesters showed up on March 14th to express their concerns about budget proposals being made by Governor Nikki Haley. The call in South Carolina is for a moral budget that cuts special interest tax breaks ahead of plans to slash funding for important public services. Opponents say that $3.7 billion is lost in the current budget due to sales and service tax exemptions. In Maine yesterday, it was a lobby day for workers concerned about right-to-work legislation that is currently proposed in the legislature. The legislation being proposed in Maine has similar language as bills in other states that were written partially with the influence of a Virginia organization called the National Right to Work Committee. Employees in Maine are fighting the legislation because they've seen the numbers that have come out of other states that already have similar legislation. On average, right to work states spend less on school children, the average wages are more than $5,000 lower than non-right to work states, and those states average more than 19% of citizens living below the poverty rate. The national average in 2009 was 14.3%. Maine's rate was 16.9%. Meanwhile, in Indiana, 39 House Democrats continue to hide out in neighboring Illinois in opposition to the majority of the House Republican agenda. The legislators have been out of state for more than a month, and it's unknown when they'll return. The Democrats have said they won't return until Republicans can show they are willing to negotiate. But House Speaker Brian Bosma has repeated, often, that he won't make any compromises. While the Democrats waited out in an Illinois hotel, taxpayers continue to protest at the State House in Indianapolis. Today is day 30 of protests in that state. In nearby Missouri, the state Senate faced more than 500 workers on March 15th and watched as Republicans were unable to rally enough votes to bring right-to-work legislation in that state. The opposition saw members of the Republican side of the aisle defecting to their camp. These are only a handful of the states currently facing various forms of collective bargaining legislation. Many of these rallies and protests are expected to come to a head on April 4th, when employees and supporters around the country will gather in state capitals and major cities to give a voice to workers on the day Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated while protesting for the rights of sanitation workers in Memphis.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
All right, we're back, and you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and online at weft.org. And unfortunately, Tom Thomas isn't here today, so we don't have the cultural corner. I suppose I could have been playing his music while we did our PSAs here, but we're going to go right into the PSAs this week. So Jason's got something for us. And
I don't know if we would have been infringing on a copyright for Tom if we'd played his music for something else.
I don't know. Maybe.
Public service announcement. We all have something of value to give to a child. All it takes to become a mentor is the desire to make a difference. Contact Lauren Smith in Champaign at 351-3722 or Barbara Linder in Urbana at 337-0853 for information about how you can make mentoring a part of your life.
Bob? Okay, homelessness is a problem that still exists in our community. Have you ever wondered what you could do to help? Well, the Time Center in Champaign is a transitional living program for homeless men, providing meals, housing, and professional staff 24/7 to assist in ending homelessness in our community, one person at a time. To find out how you can volunteer, call 398-7785. That's 398-7785. Jason, you got another one there?
Does your family have a plan in the event of an emergency? Emergencies are almost always unexpected. So many people are caught unprepared when they happen. Don't let this happen to you. Take the time to talk to your family about creating an emergency plan. Talk about things like where to meet, who would pick up the kids, and what supplies you should have. Go to ready.gov for more information on getting prepared for any emergency. This message has been brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Okay. Well, as many people probably heard, yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York. So I got a little bit of music here from a band named Rasputin, and they had a CD come out in 1996, Thanks for the Ether. This is their song, My Little Shirtwaist Fire.
Tomorrow.
Well, we'll start that over. That's not what I wanted to play there. My Little Shirtwaist Fire.
Once it started and frail and big-hearted, just withered to the floor. Oh, so sadly we examined hands badly by that which no man fears more. The terrible flames of all that remains of my shirtwaist fire. My best friend was alone in the alcove. Does anyone see her there? Such a sweet face trapped in the staircase by the smell of her own burning hair. The terrible flames of all that remains of my shirtwaist fire. Broken glass, the embers that nobody knows. We'll be so inside, there's whistling and burning, we're burning apart. So burning, can you help us, please? So picking one up on the knees of my little shirtwaist fire. Girls work hard for small rewards or invitations to dine. A one-turned word from one who loves them, but what I have earned is mine. Terrible flames of all that remains of mine. Little shirtwaist fire. Broken glimmers, the embers that died, that nobody knows. When we so excited, just in burning, the girls been a fire. Is there anybody, can you help us, please? Is there begging, or I'm gonna need some more? Little shirtwaist fire.
Rasputin with My Little Shirtwaist Fire. And now Jason has a special historical look at some of the events surrounding the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. Jason?
Yes, absolutely, Bob. This was just a monumental event in labor history and really the events in the history of our nation in the early 20th century. If anyone had listened to Democracy Now! Yesterday, they did an outstanding job on talking
about
that.
Yes, they did. It was an excellent show yesterday.
Really was. I mean, among a typically strong show, that was really one of the best I've heard. They had some great historians on, Stephen Frazier and Annalise Orlek, who I believe Orlek's grandmother had worked at Triangle Shirtwaist, too, so it was historically relevant for them, and connected it to some contemporary issues, especially a similar fire that we talked about here on Illinois World Labor Hour that occurred on December 14th, 2010, in Bangladesh, in Dhaka,
right.
Where 26 workers had died and plummeted to their death really under similar circumstances on a high floor, locked in too. And I think a couple of things just to briefly preface this. What I want to do is I want to read something from a newspaper reporter from the Milwaukee Journal. William Shepard had dictated this to Roy Howard across the phone, and Howard ended up relaying this story that Shepard had seen unfold at the time in New York City. And it's important to note, too, because this was something that work in so many instances is distant from people's eyes. It's, you know, the workplaces are oftentimes out of sight, out of mind from people. Not always, but so often. And even for this distant place up on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of this building in lower Manhattan, this ended up becoming a very public event that people had witnessed this horrible tragedy. And so I want to read this, and it's really painful, but I think stark and well worth remembering these events in which 146 young, mostly immigrant, and mostly women garment workers had perished, that led to a spate of labor legislation in New York State. And Bob has some stuff, too, about this later, about Francis Perkins having been involved in this. But, this inspired an awful lot of people. And Shepard's account is really harrowing, but I think important to read. I was walking through Washington Square when a puff of smoke issuing from the factory building caught my eye. I reached the building before the alarm was turned in. I saw every feature of the tragedy visible from outside the building. I learned a new sound, a more horrible sound than description can picture. It was the thud of a speeding living body on a stone sidewalk. Thud dead, thud dead, thud dead, thud dead. 62 thud deads. I call them that because the sound and the thought of death came to me each time at the same instant. There was plenty of chance to watch them as they came down. The height was 80 feet. The first 10 thud deads shocked me. I looked up, saw that there were scores of girls at the windows. The flames from the floor below were beating in their faces. Somehow I knew that they, too, must come down, and something within me, something that I didn't know was there, steeled me. I even watched one girl falling, waving her arms, trying to keep her body upright until the very instant she struck the sidewalk. She was trying to balance herself. Then came the thud, then a silent, unmoving pile of clothing and twisted, broken limbs. As I reached the scene of the fire, a cloud of smoke hung over the building. I looked up to the 7th floor. There was a living picture in each window, 4 screaming heads of girls waving their arms. "Call the firemen," they screamed, scores of them. "Get a ladder," cried others. They were all as alive and whole and sound as we were who stood on the sidewalk. I couldn't help thinking of that. We cried to them not to jump. We heard the siren of a fire engine in the distance. The other sirens sounded from several directions. "Here they come," we yelled. "Don't jump. Stay there." One girl climbed onto the window sash. Those behind her tried to hold her back. Then she dropped into space. I didn't notice whether those above watched her drop because I had turned away. Then came that first thud. I looked up. Another girl was climbing onto the windowsill. Others were crowding behind her. She dropped. I watched her fall, and again the dreadful sound. 2 windows away, 2 girls were climbing onto the sill. They were fighting each other and crowding for air. Behind them I saw many screaming heads. They fell almost together, but I heard 2 distinct thuds. Then the flames burst out through the windows on the floor below them, and curled up into their faces. The firemen began to raise a ladder. Others took out a life net. And while they were rushing to the sidewalk with it, 2 more girls shot down. The firemen held it under them. The bodies broke it. The grotesque simile of a dog jumping through a hoop struck me. Before they could move the net, another girl's body flashed through it. The thuds were just as loud, it seemed, as if there had been no net there. It seemed to me that the thuds were so loud that they might have been heard all over the city. I had counted 10. Then my dulled senses began to work automatically. I noticed things that it had not occurred to me before to notice. Little details that the first shock had blinded me to. I looked up to see whether those above watched those who fell. I noticed that they did. They watched them every inch of the way down and probably heard the roaring thuds that we heard. As I looked up, I saw a love affair in the midst of all the horror. A young man helped a girl to the windowsill. Then he held her out, deliberately away from the building, and let her drop. He seemed cool and calculating. He held out a second girl the same way and let her drop. Then he held out a third girl who did not resist. I noticed that. They were as unresisting as if he were helping them onto a streetcar instead of into eternity. Undoubtedly, he saw that a terrible death awaited them in the flames, and his was only a terrible chivalry. Then came the love amid the flames. He brought another girl to the window. Those of us who were looking saw her put her arms around him and kiss him. Then he held her out into space and dropped her. But quick as a flash, he was on the windowsill himself. His coat fluttered upward. The air filled his trouser legs. I could see he wore tan shoes and hose. His hat remained on his head. Thud dead. Thud dead. Together they went into eternity. I saw his face before they covered it. You could see in it that he was a real man. He had done his best. We found out later that in the room in which he stood, many girls were being burned to death by the flames and were screaming in an inferno of flame and heat. He chose the easiest way and was brave enough to even help the girl he loved to a quicker death after she had given him a goodbye kiss. He leaped with an energy as if to arrive first in that mysterious land of eternity, but her thud dead came first. The fireman raised the longest ladder. It reached only to the sixth floor. I saw the last girl jump at it and miss it, and then the faces disappeared from the window. But now the crowd was enormous. Though all this had occurred in less than 7 minutes, the start of the fire and the thuds and deaths. I heard screams around the corner and hurried there. What I had seen before was not so terrible as what had followed. Up on the ninth floor, girls were burning to death before our very eyes. They were jammed in the windows. No one was lucky enough to be able to jump, it seemed. But one by one, the jams broke. Down came the bodies in a shower, burning, smoking, flaming bodies, with disheveled hair trailing upward. They had fought each other to die by jumping instead of by fire. The whole sound, unharmed girls who had jumped on the other side of the building had tried to fall feet down, but these fire torches, suffering ones, fell inertly, only intent that death should come to them on the sidewalk instead of in the furnace behind them. On the sidewalk lay heaps of broken bodies. A policeman later went about with tags, which he fastened with wires to the wrists of the dead girls, numbering each with a lead pencil, and I saw him fasten tag number 54 to the wrist of a girl who wore an engagement ring. A fireman who came downstairs from the building told me that there were at least 50 bodies in the big room on the seventh floor. Another fireman told me that more girls had jumped down an air shaft in the rear of the building. I went back there, into the narrow court, and saw a heap of dead girls. The floods of water from the fireman's hose that ran into the gutter were actually stained red with blood. I looked onto the heap of dead bodies, and I remembered these girls were the shirtwaist makers. I remembered their great strike of last year in which these same girls had demanded more sanitary conditions and more safety precautions in the shops. Their dead bodies were the answer.
Excellent, Jason. You know, hi, this is Bill. A little late today. You know, hear something like this and think about things like the Ludlow Massacre and, well, actually, the many massacres that have occurred in American labor history. And you know, you always hear about all kinds of workers getting killed in one way or another, but it's pretty rare, if at all ever happens, that the capitalists who employ them do. The closest that ever came was when Berkman shot Henry Fricke, and he didn't kill him. You know, he actually survived. Apparently, Frick, however you pronounce that, stayed at his desk and kept working till the end of the day. But I'm kind of upset lately about I just don't understand it. You know, there are people who do blue collar work. I guess part of this is I've been in a big email fight with a friend of mine over what's going on in Madison, Wisconsin, and this person is a fellow building trades worker
who has always been conservative, and except perhaps for his lifestyle in a misspent youth, maybe. I didn't know him back then, but I'm sure he was a partier. And I don't know. Maybe there are some differences. This guy is really into guns a whole bunch, which tends to turn people towards right-wing news sources. And beyond that, he apparently has done pretty well financially, as far as I can tell, at least much better than me, and at least in obvious ways, such as houses and things like that. And I don't know. Maybe it's like the old saying is, the American labor movement did too good of a job, and too many people, you know, got enough where they identify with the bosses. I just don't understand it. I don't know. It's frustrating. I don't know. I just.
How about if we go to some music? More Ann Feeney here.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today, right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. Going to work could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity, Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood, the list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more are gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers, and it's time we started calling the shots. When they boost your copay,
war on the workers.
Don't you know what to say?
War on the workers.
When they talk privatization,
war on the workers.
And cooperation,
war on the workers.
When they call you a team,
war on the workers.
You better learn how to scream.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. They can lock us out, they can lock us up, we cannot give in. No more lies, no compromise, we'll battle till we win. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots. When they talk flexibility,
war on the workers.
Every worker stiff can see. Now when they poison your water,
war on the workers.
Don't go like lambs to the slaughter.
War on the workers.
And when they foul up the air,
war on the workers.
You gotta show that you care.
War on the workers.
When they talk WTO,
war on the workers.
You best be screaming hell no.
War on the workers.
Oh, that's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. Education, it's a war on child labor protection, it's a war on the 8-hour day, it's a war on occupational health and safety, it's a war on social security. Now thanks to WTO, GATT, NAFTA, MAI, the IMF and the World Bank, it's a worldwide war. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Yeah, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time, sisters and brothers, you know it's time right now. I said it's time we started calling the shots.
And we're back. You are listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour here at WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM and streaming at weft.org. And Jason had a few comments.
Yeah, just to briefly sort of sum up that and also connect it to something that Bill had said that I was reading through a New York Times piece on this Triangle Shirtwaist fire. It was published the day after this had happened, 100 years ago today, in fact, that the newspaper article had come out and that the two owners of the factory got out right away, as the rest of the workers had charred.
They were up on the floor above it or something, and they got warned by a phone call?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, and
there were no phones on the work floor.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely not. And they were locked in. The workers were locked in for fear of theft, and the owners had admitted after the fact that they might have had $15 or $20 worth of materials ever stolen from them, and this was a justification for the 146 maimed, charred, and
well, geez, how much material could you carry out of a building, you know, and not get caught, man?
What were they getting paid? They paid 14 cents an hour?
Yeah, it was really a matter of cents, and had struck for not simply wages, but especially working conditions in 1909 and 1910, and what was referred to as the revolt of the 20,000 in 1910 over so many of these same issues. Pay, but especially these very working conditions, which I working might add, condition. By the way, yeah. Before turning it over back to you guys, that this facility hadn't really been cleaned up sufficiently for months, where there were the frayed materials and, you know, basically the droppings of materials from roughly 100,000 collars around the floor. This place was in addition to what they did anyway, but with all this scrap, it was a veritable tinderbox that it was apparently from cigarette ashes was how this fire had started. So, you know, they couldn't have worked in more difficult, miserable, and deadly conditions.
Well, also, too, I remember on Democracy Now! Yesterday, Amy Goodman mentioned also to keep union organizers out. That's one reason why they had the doors locked. So that was probably more of a main reason. I mean, I just can't see anybody being able to steal an appreciable amount of cloth. You know, that's just ridiculous. And like I said, man, it's always the workers getting killed. It's you know, the machine guns at the homestead, and even in more modern times, when you're watching Harlan County, USA, there's a scene there, and it's too dark where there's not anything. You can't see anything but flashes, but there are shots being fired from within the mine property at the women who are picketing at night. You know, that's, and I'm just appalled that when fellow blue collar people, it just blows my mind that they can't figure it out, man. The corporate people and the billionaires are not your friends.
No way.
You know, it's not to say that, and of course, we have major problems here with people who run unions and such and how unions operate also. But I mean, man, the Koch brothers, they would stomp you into the dust if they had the opportunity. And they're taking the opportunities everywhere they can. I was just reading a big article. There was a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and he was writing on his blog about and so now there's a big freedom of information, but the Wisconsin information law. Well, I don't really care about that. I think you ought to not just whine about that and let that go. Because that's for everybody using, you know, he should be, I guess, you get a Yahoo account and use computers at home.
I came across a story this week about the Koch brothers and the Native American reservation oil theft. Interesting about how they made their money. Just what is this Koch industry? Should it be called a company? If so, we need to rethink the idea of what a company and a business is supposed to be.
Well, the brother of one of the
Koch Industries owners, David and Charles Koch, called the company an organized crime operation.
Yeah, but anyway, this professor, what he had done was, and I'd seen this information elsewhere too, and he describes himself as a centrist, pragmatic centrist, and what he had done is identified that group is called ALEC. I can't remember what that's. And stands for now, but it's a right-wing group that you can join yourself for a few, for so many thousands of dollars, depending on what industry you represent. And then Republican legislators can join it for $100, and they get together and they write all this legislation. And his point was that this legislation is not being generated within Wisconsin itself or within Indiana or within Michigan. It's being generated by people in these right-wing groups. And also this guy, he goes through and he's very careful to point out that my information is mainly coming from left-wing watchdog groups,
right,
because I can't get it from the groups that I'm studying, and there are no like right-wing watchdog groups that are watching these people. So be careful, because you know what I have comes from things with a bias. And he seems to be a very fair person in that matter, and very knowledgeable and academic. And but it's just, that's just what it is, man. It's these, and that's what you were talking about taxes earlier. That's the problem. And that's why a lot of people are starting to lean possibly more towards a flat income tax with absolutely no deductions. And I've argued this with many people, but then on the other hand, once you start opening that door for deductions, you know, then, you know, they were supposed to be starting out as pro-social. It's like you have to reinvest in stuff here in the United States. And then the corporate lobbyists got in and took it over and just completely perverted it. And if you're interested in this topic, a really good book to read is Perfectly Legal by David K. Johnson, and that's K-C-A-Y. And it's just amazing. It's like there are deductions written into the tax code that are obviously written for individual people or their businesses. And that would be like, let's say Bob here. I don't know what year you founded your business, but let's say that there is a deduction written in there for all computer consulting businesses in Champaign, Illinois, founded at such and such a date, and right, so on and so forth. I mean, you know, it would be obvious that it was written perfectly for you. I don't know why they just don't name it, but maybe there's a constitutionality involved there. Like, you cannot write a law that is against an individual person. That's called a bill of attainder. And that is unconstitutional. So maybe you can't write an individual law that helps an individual at the same time. But it's just things like that, and it's all perverted. And it's I don't know.
On this point on Cronin, I think this is all very important.
Yeah, Cronin.
William Cronin, who's written a lot of books. He's this historian. Nature's Metropolis is maybe most famous. It's interesting to note, too, that this is occurring, and Bill's characterizations, I think, are quite good on this, and he was, I think, very careful to point out he wasn't against people lobbying or organizations lobbying, saying it's part of the democratic process.